evening. It is Thursday, April 9th, 2020, and it is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. There are those in the Trump administration who are encouraged by positive virus data showing fewer deaths than once projected that are working behind the scenes to help the president to reopen this country on the 1st of May. That will be consistent with the end of the White House's 30 days to slow the spread statement. Is this good science? Is this good sense? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. As always, Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So HHS officials say, quote, talk of reopening the economy when we don't fully understand the virus and can't even crank our own domestic assembly lines to make diagnostic tests, respirators, and ventilators isn't just myopic, it's flat out ridiculous, end quote. Your thoughts on a May 1st so-called reopening of the country?
I totally agree. It's ridiculous. I mean, the U.S. still hasn't gotten a handle on this problem. I mean, not only are masks in short supply and other protective gear and ventilators and tests, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. 12 states still are not on lockdown for reasons I can't comprehend. But the point is that, you know, whatever favorable signs people may be discerning out in the horizon, the fact is the virus is still raging, especially here in New York where I am. And there just simply is no hope of bringing it under control within 3 weeks so that people can resume a normal life. In fact, they really won't be able to resume a normal life at all until a vaccine is developed. And that means that the crisis could stretch, you know, through the summer and into the fall. There simply is no good answer to the problem. The U.S. was caught woefully short by this outbreak. It now has got to, you know, play catch up through social distancing, and I can't see how it can possibly let up at this early date.
To your point, I live in Silver Spring, Maryland, and there is discussion here, as well as in some districts in Virginia, some school districts in Virginia, they're talking about distance learning in the fall. Now, this discussion coming from the White House, this says to me that there are those in the administration that are less concerned with the impact of the pandemic on public health and more concerned with mitigating the politic or the political impact on the presidency.
Well, I think the real concern, by the way, is economic. They want to just get the economy up and going and get profits going, and they're less concerned about the health and welfare of the broader population than they are of the individual well-being of individual capitalists.
Let me jump in and interrupt you and say this and get your take on along the same line. I had someone say to me earlier today that when your language is war, we're in a war against the coronavirus, that language also conveys a mindset. And when you're in war, there is something called collateral damage. It's an acceptable loss of human life based upon the circumstances you find yourself confronted with. And so this person said to me, so when you hear a president talking about a public health pandemic in the context of war, they are telling you there's a level of death that they are willing to accept.
I agree, though. The whole war imagery is completely inappropriate. I mean, this is a public health emergency. Now, in response to which the U.S. so far has, you know, gets flunking grades. I mean, it's doing such a poor job, far and away the worst job of any comparable country on earth, you know, it's really a scandal. Americans don't have an effective government. They've got some kind of, you know, ragtag, you know, 18th century facsimile, but the government is not doing its job. And any talk of returning to normal in a mere 3 weeks is crazy.
The CDC posted guidance on how critical employees who have been exposed to COVID-19 can return to work, but readily available testing for all Americans and antibody testing isn't there yet. So what concerns me as a policy guy is how momentum from this type of dialogue and narrative can develop and action gets ahead of sound public health policy. Your thoughts?
I agree. I mean, I should say, you know, I am a recovered COVID-19 victim. Somewhere around March 23rd, I developed a fever, and it was a low grade fever, 99.5 to 100, but it was exhausting, and it went on for 10 or 12 days, and it was really a long, exhausting process. But now I'm fully recovered. I'm happy to say, but I don't know if I'm still shedding viruses. I don't know if I'm still immune, and without any kind of testing mechanism, I can't be sure. So if I were to go to some office, I don't know whether I'd be making things better or worse.
Were you given hydroxychloroquine?
I took it. I don't know. We had a pre-existing supply in our medicine cabinet. I took it. I don't know what effect it had. But the point is, you know, now I'm all better. But I still could be shedding viruses, and I still could be putting others at risk if I were to, you know, go to an office or some other workplace. Unfortunately, the country is so ill-prepared that it can't answer these very elementary questions. So what did I say? Like, you know, talk about, you know, returning to work, returning to normal in 3 weeks is just batty, because it just completely ignores the real state of affairs out there.
Driving a lot of this discussion of a May 1 opening, in my opinion, is the news that another 6.6 million Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week as layoffs show no let up. And we've got economists, they had estimated 5.5 million workers filed claims last week. This is according to Bloomberg. A total of 10 million sought benefits the prior 2 weeks, figures that dwarf the previous record of 695,000 weekly unemployment applications during the deep recession in October of 82. So to your point, there's an awful lot of economic motivation here, which then translates into political motivation to get this country open by the 1st of May.
Yeah, but like the danger is you'll just make it worse. I mean, look at the federal government, the Trump administration made it much, much worse because, you know, via their slow response. And as they open the country back, you know, open prematurely, they'll have an even bigger problem on their hands a few weeks later down the road. So this kind of precipitous action is counterproductive. It'll wind up compounding the problem. And you don't want to do that. You want to just tackle the problem once and for all, bring it under control. That is the only way to minimize the economic damage. And if the government had taken concerted action, back in early January, we wouldn't be where we are now.
Two things to that point. One, I was speaking to a physician a couple of days ago, and she made the same point. And I drew the parallel to a relapse when you leave the house too early after having the flu. You have the symptoms of the flu. You feel better a day or two. You go on outside. You go to the golf course. You do whatever you do. And then a day or two later, you find yourself relapsing. And the relapse is worse than the original flu that you had.
Yes. Yes. And if you open the country back up, then all the people, you know, congregate together, and the disease, you know, then takes another leap upward.
Especially when we still have a number of states that have never shut down in the first place.
And why that is, I just don't know.
So, Daniel, Attorney General William Barr calls current restrictions, quote unquote, draconian, and suggests they should be revisited next month. He says, quote, when this period of time at the end of April expires, I think we have to allow people to adapt more than we have and not just tell people to go home and hide under their bed, but allow them to use other ways, social distancing and other means to protect themselves, end quote. Is it a coincidence that the White House talks of May 1 and yesterday the DOJ via the Attorney General echoes the same line? Going back to my earlier point, what concerns me as a policy guy is how momentum from this type of dialogue can develop and action gets ahead of sound public policy.
Yeah, I think it's clear that Barr is taking his signals from Trump. Trump wants to wants to get people back on the job by May 1st, and Barr has gotten his marching orders. So Barr is making various noises in support of that sentiment. But I just don't see how it's possible. I don't see how you can have social distancing without people staying home. I mean, going to work is the opposite. You know, when people go to work, they work in close proximity with their fellow workers. That's what happens at a workplace. And that is the opposite of social distancing. So the U.S. is facing a problem. It's got to stick with its policy despite the severe economic consequences.
So do you have any confidence that the science will carry the day? Or are you more concerned that the politics and the economics will carry the day?
I think the latter is already carrying the day. I think the Trump administration's approach to this entire problem has been hesitant, of two minds, and therefore ineffectual. And that's why the arc of the disease is rising straight up. I think the Trump administration has been uniquely incompetent among advanced industrial democracies when it comes to dealing with this problem. And because Trump, as I said, doesn't know what he wants to do. He wants to, you know, he wants to somehow get over this problem, and he wants to minimize the economic damage, but he doesn't realize that he can't do both things at once. He's got to make the hard choices and embark upon the difficult policies and stick with those policies until the task is accomplished.
Daniel Lazar, as always, thank you so much for your time. Greatly, greatly appreciate your insight. I'm glad that you're back on the path to good, strong health and look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. According to Anya Parampil, in Haiti's fight against coronavirus, some estimates suggest up to 800,000 Haitians may die as a result of the disease, as the country's health infrastructure has been gutted by U.S.-allied neoliberal governments, which have controlled the country since 2004. What's really going on in Haiti? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a Haitian community activist and host of a Haitian radio broadcast called La Coup in New York, Dahoud André. Welcome to The Critical Hour.
Thank you very much, Brother Leon. The radio program is Héritier Papa Dessalines, which means the highest, the children of Jean-Jacques Dessalines. And it's aired Monday and Tuesdays on Haitian Community Radio Omega in Brooklyn, out of Brooklyn, and it's broadcast in Haiti as well. Well, with the situation of the coronavirus in Haiti, the important thing that we want people to understand is, looking at the chaos that is happening here in the United States, you know, they say the richest country in the world. It can be imagined, but with not enough masks for doctors and nurses, you can imagine the reality in a country such as Haiti that does not have a real government. It's a bunch of puppets that are put in place by, we call them the enemies of Haiti, the United States, Canada, France. They call themselves the core group, basically a bunch of thieves who are just looking for every opportunity to make some money. And they are backed by the United States. Now, the number 800,000, you know, it's as accurate as the 2 to 3 million death estimate that, you know, a couple of weeks ago was being thrown out by U.S. officials. It's not a real number. The reality, nobody knows exactly. As we are speaking now, the numbers are very low for Haiti. They're saying 30 as of right now, as we're speaking, 30 confirmed positives and 2 confirmed deaths. But again, this means nothing because Haiti has tested less than 400 people as we're speaking now, you know? And the government really has no grasp of what's happening in the totality of the country. And the government, for example, is telling people to wash their hands so many times a day for 20 seconds with soap and water. But the government knows as well as I do that, you know, a large majority of the population has no access to clean running water, potable water to do this. And, you know, they know that in the beginning they had announced that there were 200 beds, hospital beds that were prepared, you know, for isolating coronavirus patients, but they could not disclose where they were. And when the first cases started showing up, it was clear, it became clear that they did not really exist. So it is the reality. And we want to say so many other countries around the world, because Haiti is not the only country in this reality. They have no resources really to do. I mean, look at the United States, you know, 340 million population. And yet, I don't think that the United States has tested 2 million people yet, you know? And so this is the reality. I'm in New York right now, and we know people that are sick, that have some symptoms, but they are not able to be tested right here in New York. They are not able to be taken care of the way that they should be taken care of here in New York. So that's how we read the situation in Haiti and the number, 800,000 number. It's not a real number. It's just, you know, an estimate.
Yeah, it's a projection. It is
exactly.
It is definitely a projection. There are
not based in reality, is what I'm saying.
Okay. There are, as my research shows, about 11.3 million people in Haiti. Is that about right?
That's about what is said. But, you know, most of, there's no way to know. But
understood.
It's a number that's used, yeah.
According to Anya Parampil's article, 64 ventilators and an estimated 30 to 120 functioning ICU beds.
Well, this made a lot of controversy in Haiti about 2 weeks ago when people were saying, okay, so where are these 60-whatever ventilators? And only, I think they were able to find 30, and most of them were not working. But I'm sure, like I said, Haiti is not the only country in this situation.
Sure.
Yesterday, you know, on my radio program, we were talking about the government of Barbados, who had press conference and complaining that they had ordered 20 ventilators, and the U.S. government basically seized those 20 ventilators. So it's not just Haiti.
To your point about the government informing people to wash their hands, but clean water is a problem, access to soap is a problem. And the other issue in terms of the government directing people to stay at home, but because of the nature of the Haitian economy, people can't afford to stay at home.
You know, here in New York, on my radio program last night, I had the State Assemblyman Charles Barron on the program. And him and his wife, Inez Barron, she's a city councilwoman in New York City, they both tested positive a few weeks ago, and they put out this press release denouncing the fact that most of the people here in New York who are dying, who are African-Americans, Latinos here in New York City. And of course, why is that? Because about staying at home. Who can stay at home? A lot of the workers here who are making minimum wage or close to minimum wage, they cannot stay at home in this reality here in New York. They have to go out there. It's either, like the people in Haiti are saying, it's either we die of hunger or we die of coronavirus, because there's no government infrastructure to take care of people who choose to stay at home. And I'm telling you, it's a direct comparison between what's happening here in New York and so many other places with poor and what they call minority communities here and the reality in Haiti. Also, social distancing, to stay this kind of distance apart from certain people, even inside your own home. This is just not something that is possible in like a studio apartment or a one-bedroom apartment with four people living in there here in New York. And let's look at in Haiti, where every day, you know, you have people traveling in the tap-taps, the community buses that are made, you know, to hold maybe 20 people, and they have 30 to 40 people in them. That's the reality of our lives. And the people in Haiti, they held a demonstration last week, because while the government is saying that people have to stay a certain distance apart, and the government had amassed like thousands of people at the Champs in Port-au-Prince to go and register to get these ID cards that are going to be used for electoral, for voting in Haiti. And so the people were saying, yeah, this is how you're going to say to stay this distance apart. And here is a government itself amassing like thousands of people in a cramped space. So for poor people who are poor, who don't have, you know, mom, dad, two children, or one child in a three-bedroom home with a finished basement, you know, it's not a reality. The social distancing, people who have resources, people who have the means to stock up on food, and water, and, you know, essential stuff that they need, this might appear like a reality for them. But for people who are living day to day, if they don't go out in the streets today, they're not eating today. It's just not a reality. And I think this is why we're looking at so many more deaths in our communities in the United States. And Charles Barron, Assemblyman Charles Barron, and Councilwoman Inez Barron, this is what they called for in the press release that they put out, is that the government of New York State and New York City and the U.S., because it's not just in New York that this reality exists, you know, Chicago, you know the numbers, Louisiana, that they have to recognize this and they have to invest accordingly. There are the Javits Center, and the governor of New York that so many people are looking at as a hero right now, Andrew Cuomo. But the reality is that since 2011 he has been governor of New York, and he has closed so many hospitals in Black poor community areas that today might have been used. And then the current budget for New York State, he's cut $400 million. That's the one that's, you know, in the hands of the legislators right now, Charles was saying. He cut $400 million for Medicaid. And so imagine that here, that has so much resources, and in Haiti. In our hospitals in Haiti, the main hospital, for example, the General Hospital of Haiti in Port-au-Prince, doctors, nurses, he basically walked off the job. And because they don't have masks, the government has not given them, they don't have any resources, any beds, no possibility of isolating patients. You know, and this is I'm sure this is not just in Haiti. I think this is the reality in most countries in Africa right now. I'm sure this is the reality in so many other places around the world where, you know, the resources are just not there to do these things that are being talked about. And I think when people are looking at the numbers, you know, you're looking at so many countries in Africa that have such low numbers. You know, South Africa, 2,000, about 2,000 confirmed cases. You know, and South Africa is basically a relatively rich country in Africa. And you're looking at, you know, Ghana with 313 cases, Nigeria, 276 cases. This is simply because the governments in these countries are not testing millions of our people. They don't have the means to do it. And so it looks like that.
I've got to stop you there, Mr. Dawood André. Thank you so much for your time. I look forward to calling you back and getting you back on the show, because there is so much more relative to this issue that we need to cover.
Thank you very much, Brother Leon.
Oh, thank you. And thank you so much for your patience. I really, really appreciate it. You are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Many of these NGOs and international human rights organizations are really covers for neoliberal interventionist governments. According to The Gray Zone, billionaire-backed Human Rights Watch lobbies for lethal U.S. sanctions on leftist governments as the COVID-19 crisis rages. How concerned should we be? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He hosts Voices with Vision on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. He's a Pan-Africanist internationalist organizer intimately involved with political prisoner causes from Mumia Abu-Jamal to the Cuban Five. And he's also a co-founder of Pan-Africanist Community Action, Netfa Freeman. Netfa, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
So there is this stereotype that these non-government organizations, these NGOs, these so-called pro-democracy organizations are actually that pro-democracy. But what we're finding out time and time again is that many of them are actually doing the work today that the CIA used to do.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And then, the term democracy, just characterizing that as what they, you know, that's always the sort of trope that used to be used back in the Cold War era of the anti-communist movement, the things that are supposedly anti-communist, but were really anti-self-determination, anti the people's movements for socialism that were happening around the world, and particularly in Latin America and Africa. And so they always say they're fighting for democracy and that the groups that they're fighting against are anti-democracy, but really the people are struggling for their liberation, they're gaining independence and trying to exercise self-determination through governments. And so that's what we're seeing. So as we saw that, and that being also tied to the Cold War in the sense that a lot of the, historically speaking, a lot of the support that those forces could get, the forces fighting for liberation, a lot of times was only from the Soviet Union. But it didn't mean that they were puppets of the Soviet Union. It just meant that that was the only place they could get. And then U.S. imperialism, which posits itself as some, you know, benevolent force fighting for the liberation of other people, are trying to overthrow these governments. And this is what we see now. And along with them engaging in the media assault, the propaganda that helps their populace, their internal populations accept their nefarious motives in foreign policy, they have a media coverage. Then they also combine that media coverage with creating these human rights organizations, these pro-democracy groups, some of them on the ground, largely funded by and indirectly funded by the U.S. government, actually. A lot of the organizations are getting indirect funds by the U.S. government by so-called NGO or front groups like the Freedom House and all that, that are in the National Endowment for Democracy and all those groups that are actually get all of their money from appropriations by the United States, by the U.S. Congress. And so then they go through and they fund these groups. And all of these groups, normally, when you look at it, it seems really obvious because when it comes to human rights, and that's their thing is talking about human rights abuses, they never talk about the blatant and disgusting human rights abuses that the United States government commits with their wars, atrocious wars abroad, and bombing people and doing all kind of other things, having relationships with governments that have bad human rights records. They always only target the targets of the U.S. government regime change plans. So those countries that are trying to establish socialism, trying to establish self-determination, they serve as sort of a propaganda, a destabilization that's more than just propaganda also, because they'll also work with their proxies on the ground inside the countries, posing as human rights activists, posing as independent media, quote unquote, that's, you know, supposedly not tied to what their country's media is. And they serve as to legitimize the foreign policy designs that the U.S. government is trying to manipulate on the ground in different countries.
And a perfect example of that is Human Rights Watch. And we assume because their name is Human Rights Watch and they issue a number of reports about allegedly atrocities around the world, we find now that they are depicting the sanctions against Venezuela and sanctions against Nicaragua in the midst of this coronavirus. They are championing and advocating for sanctions against countries in Latin America.
Yeah, and it really should be very obvious, but unfortunately, it should be obvious to a lot of people, I think, looking at it, how obscene this is. When the world, we see a lot of countries trying to establish cooperation and work together to fight the pandemic, we see them making it hard for countries to do so, even stepping up sanctions and things like that make it hard for countries to get in, import the medicines they need and the equipment and the protective gear and things that they need to fight the pandemic. So they should, even if all, you know, whatever difference may exist, they don't even have the moral orientation to at least put those things on hold for a while. So, and like you mentioned Human Rights Watch, which really has it's like a class A example of what I was trying to describe before, going back to the Cold War and the anti-communist movement in terms of its formation and being created and funded by the Ford Foundation, that it's actually praising sanctions, which we should see. A lot of those of us who are, you know, analyze these the imperialist designs know that sanctions are really just another form of warfare. They're economic warfare, and they shouldn't be something that's praised. But in the midst of this, they legitimize sanctions and embrace them, which really should be very telling to people that they're embracing sanctions and not not talking about the different means of destabilization and assumption and entitlement that the United States thinks it has to impose its will on other countries. They don't even denounce that or deal with it. In fact, they aid and abet it.
To that point, Human Rights Watch Australia Development and Outreach Manager Stephanie McLennan tweeted, quote, "This is great news. U.S. sanctions on Nicaragua officials open door for accountability. In 2019, we recommended sanctions against two of the three named officials, Luis Alberto Perez Olivas and Justo Pastor Urbina, after finding evidence of grave abuses." That's just one example of how Human Rights Watch is championing these sanctions. And people need to understand that many of these governments, whether it's Venezuela, whether it's Bolivia, whether it's Brazil or Nicaragua, we're dealing with socialist-based governments that are actually doing good things, working in the best interest of their people, only to find that their efforts are challenged, thwarted, if not the leaders are deposed because of the Monroe Doctrine and the fear that the United States has in successful, positive socialist governments operating in Latin America.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of, if we could just apply a little bit more, just to the public in general, because I agree with everything you said, we just apply a little critical thinking, we can't be duped by some of those things. A lot of the, or all of the accusations that Stephanie McLennan said, leveled and saying that the particular people, they found evidence. They don't provide their sources for this. They don't provide what evidence they find. They never talk about those things. And then so Human Rights Watch and the media, because like you said, Human Rights Watch has that name, Human Rights Watch, and its credibility is there, will come and take and report, regurgitate these unsubstantiated, unfounded accusations. And then people will, because we don't really, you know, have a critical lens, will take them up without questioning them, without scrutinizing the information that we hear. And give just one quick example is that, I mean, this just should be very telling. I think it was Pompeo Abrams, I can't remember which one of these people, they reported how when there was the blackouts in Venezuela because of the power grid was blacking out, and Venezuela has reason to believe or announced their reason to believe that this was sabotaged on the part of the right wing and the United States sabotaging their power grid, the media would say Maduro dismisses, you know, electrical blackouts as, I mean, not he dismisses, he accuses the United States of being behind the blackouts, but gives no evidence. And then they add that. That's the plain idea in our mind that he's just saying it. It's like a conspiracy theory thing that we should. And then next thing you know, Pompeo, you know, and this is, some of these things are recent because like the bounty they put on Maduro's, you know, on Maduro, this was early before this. They would say Maduro, you know, he would get up and say, you know, Maduro is found to be engaged in narco trafficking. But they, when they report it, they don't put this little caveat that he didn't provide any evidence, which is true. They don't provide any evidence. They just make the accusation with nothing. And so these are the kind of things that Human Rights Watch and these organizations help to aid and abet. And then it's very clear who they're up against all the time without questioning or scrutinizing or even denouncing, which is really more appropriate, the measures, the destabilization and regime change measures that the United States takes against other countries.
And Human Rights Watch, they're calling for more sanctions to be levied against Venezuela. But scholars and independent human rights experts have long criticized Human Rights Watch for its blatant double standards against Venezuela. And it's also important to know that George Soros and his millions or billions, his billions, he's using his billions to put millions behind organizations such as Human Rights Watch. And this is incredibly, incredibly dangerous and insidious. And unfortunately, there are just too many people that give carte blanche to them because of the name Human Rights Watch.
Yeah, that's true. And then they're not the only ones. The same thing with even Amnesty International dabbles into that. also, like with Syria and things like that. And so these human rights groups, so to speak, and it's actually become almost an industry.
A cottage industry.
Yeah, and where people get paid to do what they're doing, and that's what motivates them more than any honesty or a real investigation or even acknowledging some of the universal principles that we really should be looking at that make us be able to understand the dynamics of the world, like the right of countries to have to exercise self-determination, the right of national self-determination. If something's happening there, there's no... Because it's really white supremacist, pan-European white supremacist capitalist patriarchy, where they assume, in spite of all the things they do that are horrendous and all the suffering they cause, they assume that they have the right to level sanctions against a country, to accuse countries with no evidence about being authoritarian or dictatorships or anti-democracy. And those organizations, these human rights organizations, make money or make a living or sustenance, rather, in being the propaganda arm, if you will, of helping justify this around the world.
Netfa Freeman, as always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your analysis. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Southern mayors pushed Republican governors to take action on coronavirus, and then the governors pushed back. Matt Sledge from The Intercept writes, quote, "Throughout the South, Republican governors have followed President Donald Trump's lead in resisting economic restrictions and orders to stay home. Meanwhile, mayors and local leaders, most of them Democrats, have heeded warnings from public health experts," end quote. Is this an accurate description? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a political scientist and assistant professor of Africana Studies at DePaul University, Dr. Emmett Y. Riley III. Emmett, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting.
So your overall thoughts on the fundamental premise. Do you see that Southern mayors are pushing back on Republican governors, as Republican governors have refused to follow the science and seem to be more engaged in following the president's politics?
Oh, absolutely. I think across the South, we've seen a number of examples where the executive leadership of towns and cities have gotten into public battles with governors about their response to the coronavirus pandemic. Certainly, this was the case in Jackson, Mississippi. This was also the case sort of in Tupelo, Mississippi. We also see it happening in Georgia and a number of other states where Republican governors are refusing to follow the advice of public health officials and are instead was reluctant to close down or implement curfews on towns. And they are taking that cue directly from the president. And so now you've seen a number of mayors who push back to try and get some type of leverage from some type of response from governor. So absolutely.
I think we even saw Georgia Governor Brian Kemp just a couple of days ago finally impose some stay-at-home measures. And then he had the audacity, the unmitigated gall to say that he just found out it wasn't asthma. That was yesterday with Dr. Blix. It was that he just found out that, you know, coronavirus could be spread through coughing. It was some ridiculous statement that he made.
Yeah, some absolutely ridiculous statement. I think if anybody is buying that, then they have to be something has to be wrong with them. Nobody in their right mind believes that the governor of the state did not know that the virus could be passed through, you know, with people who are asymptomatic. I think that that was attempt.
That's what it was. That's what it was.
That was a desperate attempt to cover him, cover his end. But again, I also think the Republican base don't really care. You think about there was public opinion polling released, I know about 2 weeks ago, that asked Republicans and Democrats how the president was handling the pandemic, and it split almost evenly on a partisan line with an overwhelming Republicans approval and an overwhelming majority of Democrats disapproving. And but we also see the president's approval rating ticking down nationally as well. But definitely these Republican governors don't really, they have an invested interest to keep their economies open because that's who's bankrolling their campaign. And so who pays the price is black and brown people. And as we've seen, much of the pushback have come from cities with large black populations. I think even if we look at Lori Lightfoot in Chicago, you know, publicly pushing back against the president's refusal to act and so forth.
I have been I've been saying now that it seems to me that those in the Trump administration, they're less concerned with the impact of the pandemic on public health, and they're more concerned with mitigating the political impact on the presidency.
Absolutely. This has been an attempt to change public opinion on this. Even when we think about the daily press briefings from the press from the task force, the American people are really not getting any new information from this. This becomes a damage control entity for the president because, you know, right now we're seeing that this was a colossal failure of the administration to act. The question will be whether or not what are the political implications for this for governors in states that are going to be overwhelmingly impacted by the coronavirus. You know, and you think about in places like in Mississippi where you have the mayor of Jackson publicly challenging the governor and pushing the governor, and also Tupelo, whether or not there are political ramifications for those candidates. I do know that the governor in Mississippi, who's the former lieutenant governor, is definitely not as popular as people thought he was going to be, because he was actually an unpopular Republican lieutenant governor as well.
We've had over the last couple of days some studies that have been released showing the relationship between comorbidity factors and the African-American community and the impact of the coronavirus and the incredible results, the exacerbation of those comorbidity factors and related to death. And we find that this is also manifesting itself throughout the South where a majority of African-Americans still live.
A couple comments on that is I think that when we look at healthcare outcomes for African-Americans and people of color, many of us suffer from chronic heart disease, diabetes, and then you have a epidemic that occurs at this magnitude. It's definitely going to likely have a disproportionate impact on the people, most black people in particular. And one of the interesting things about the South is we think about many of these southern states' refusals to expand the affordable or at least expand the Affordable Health Care Act. And many of their rural and local hospitals were struggling already. And so, you know, thinking about response to a national pandemic such as this, there's likely going to be issues there. But definitely, I think that the question becomes who pays the price for incompetence at the top? And oftentimes it is black people, it is brown people, it is poor people who are going to be impacted, you know, by a pandemic of this magnitude. And we're seeing that reflected in the numbers now, now that we have some data to really look at. You think about New Orleans and Louisiana having one of the highest death rates, but also thinking about how Louisiana ranks nationally in healthcare outcomes, you know, so definitely that's explaining that high death rate that's happening.
And to your point about where they rank in terms of health outcomes, unfortunately, we see throughout states in the South, they tend to be poorer states. Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, Alabama, many of them are agrarian-based economies, and they just tend to be poorer states. And so being poorer states, they have less resources to invest.
yeah, you have less resources to invest. You also have, you think about rural poverty and even urban, the small urban pockets that we have in these states. You think about companies who come and invest and mess up the environment. And so states typically are poor, and you have these poor out, you have these poor healthcare outcomes coupled with that. But then you also have states' refusal to expand our Affordable Health Care Act, which would contribute to, you know, better health outcomes, you know, for people having access to preventative care and access to medical professionals and so forth. You know, and it's just shameful that when we think about the state, the southern states in particular, that are controlled by these Republican legislatures, what they have done in terms of governance, in terms of finances for these states, and all overall healthcare outcomes have certainly regressed and put the people of those states back, particularly Black people.
Going back to Kemp in Georgia, he said, quote, "We start putting more people out of work, it creates revenue issues for the cities and for the counties and for the state. We literally could have people losing everything they've worked their entire careers for," end quote. Well, then he should be erring on the side of public health and pushing the federal government to provide the type of income protection and the type of stimulus that doesn't trickle down but trickles up.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the crazy thing about that is that you think about whose interest is being represented. He certainly is with, now what he's essentially saying is that he's willing to put the safety of the public at risk because he don't want people losing property, as opposed to supporting legislation that will support the businesses that he claims to protect. You know, this is we have entered a very dangerous era in our politics, in the sense that people are now willing to watch people die for partisan outcomes and political outcomes, which isn't all that new, but it's also profound, you know.
It is incredibly, incredibly profound. Now, so with all of that you've just said, and very accurately, and with the refusal of many of these governors to impose stay-at-home orders and whatnot, the president is now talking about trying to open the government by the 1st of May. It could be in states like Mississippi, in states like Georgia and Alabama and Arkansas, if the government is reopened before we really have a grip on this virus, those are the states that could be decimated by a resurgence of the virus.
Absolutely. That is the major risk that we have with this particular president, who refuses to give due diligence to public health officials. And you talk about reopening a state. We don't know what the numbers are going to look like by then. And so you talk about reopening, it's definitely likely to spark greater, it's likely to impact those communities much worse than it would other areas in the event that you do that.
And you've got governors that are saying that their case counts weren't high enough to warrant stay-at-home orders, but they don't give you the other side of the equation, which is that their testing has been spotty, that they haven't really been able to test enough to know, to the point you just made, what their real numbers are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we were not prepared for this pandemic in terms of our response. You think about it in terms of the healthcare professionals needing protective gear while on the line of service. And we just were not prepared. And so many of these Republican governors are looking for any excuse to suggest this is why we should be shutting down certain areas and imposing curfews on people. And so you end up with this particular situation that we're in.
Dr. Emmett Riley, as always, Emmett Y. Riley III. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your analysis. Really look forward to having you back.
All right. Thanks for that.
Thank you. All right, folks. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Remember, physical distancing, physical distancing. The data is showing that it is paying off. Wear your masks and continue to wash your hands. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.